Thanks, Carrie. You noticed that when Carrie noticed the gap here, he did not invite me to sing louder. He invited you guys to sing louder. I noticed that. We appreciate everybody's presence. I'm glad that everyone has done so well with the great blizzard of 2016 so far. It's good to see your faces this morning. And please do, as Barney mentioned in the prayer earlier, help us to be aware of those who are not with us, not able to be with us, and help us to check on them. That would be very much appreciated. It's as if the Sermon on the Mount has talked to us first about our own inner lives, and then our lives in relation to the character of God, and then in relation to the watchfulness of the people around us or the opinions of people around us. And now the sermon turns its attention to how we deal with the stuff, the lure of the stuff that's all around us in the material world. At my request recently, my old friend Rue Douglas sent me a copy of a large piece that he, almost a little booklet that he has written about his experience in World War II. He was born in 1925 down in Carroll County, Arkansas, and was drafted into the Army at age 18. And he served in the 23rd Regiment of the 2nd Infantry Division during the war. In April, or in the end of 1944, 1945, along in there, his unit spent 270 consecutive days engaged with enemy forces. I never knew that. I was around him a lot, and I never knew that he even served. He won't describe any battle. He doesn't believe in war. But some of what he has written is so touching to me that I want to share one paragraph about it. He mentions something that happened in April of 1945. It involved the city of Leipzig, which was the fifth largest city in Germany, a city which did not have much damage from bombing because it was so well protected by anti-aircraft guns, and it was so well protected because there was a great deal of manufacturing of war materials which occurred in that city. Now, I pick up his paragraph. My platoon and I helped capture the SS headquarters building at Leipzig. I took some of my squad to search out the basement for hidden away German soldiers while other troops were searching through the floors above. We didn't find anyone hidden in the basement, but we did find some plywood boxes about 4 foot square and 30 inches high. I pried the lid up on one of the boxes to see what was in it, and to my amazement, it was full of jewelry. I called my comrades over, and we began to pick out diamond rings and things. Some of our high-ranking officers came down the stairs and told us to put them back, and we grudgingly did. We found out a little later that there were several million dollars worth of jewelry in those boxes that the Germans had robbed from captured countries and the Jewish people. That was the closest I ever came to being a millionaire. Think about the different ways, the different relationships to material treasures that are mentioned in that little paragraph. There were some who had taken them from other people who never benefited from them in any way, never would. There were some to whom they had belonged who had had them taken and perhaps most likely never got them back. There were some who discovered them and had great interest with them, but benefited from them in no way other than the story that I've just mentioned. In this past week, if you paid attention in the news, to the news at all, you'll notice that these different relationships to material treasures are still very much in play. Have you heard anything about the stock market? Or the lottery? Sometimes I wonder if the two are related. Have you heard anything about a teen who's a victim of affluenza? Those kinds of things are always going on. And in our passage this morning, our text from Matthew 6, I think Jesus takes up these same kinds of relations that we may have to material things, to money and all that money buys, but also to pleasures, to attitudes toward this world, to our viewpoints about values in general. I'd like to read from you a passage that has in it some of the most famous statements Jesus ever made, some vivid contrast, and some things that ought to stick in our minds as we go along. The Lord says, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys, and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Well, that passage has in it instruction about how we're to navigate this material world in which we live. It deals with each of our lives and with how we go about in our efforts to make our lives count for something. I have titled this study the Make It Count Principles. There are three of them in this passage. The Lord is talking about how we make our lives count for something that's worthwhile. This will be expanded on in the rest of the sermon, but here it's a crucial statement for us who live in this world. Here are the three principles. Number one, the Lord tells us to have treasures that will last. In order to deal with this material world, have treasures that will last. It's interesting in verses 19 through 21, Jesus doesn't question whether we will have any treasures. He just talks about what kind of treasures we are laying up and what kind of treasures we're devoting ourselves to. Isn't it interesting to you that he doesn't say, have no treasures? In fact, he encourages us to be engaged in laying up treasures. It's just what kind that makes all the difference in the world. What are treasures? If everybody is a possessor of some kind of treasure, then what's that talking about? Well, our treasures are anything that we love the best. The things that we yearn to possess most. Our treasures are what we fear to lose, what we're unwilling to give up. Our treasures are things that have our affections and our wills and our beings. It's what we devote our attention to, our interest to, our time in, our energies toward. Our treasure is what we invest ourselves in, what we are investing ourselves in. You don't have any choice about whether you have treasures. You do have a great choice as to what kind of treasure. On the one hand, there are treasures that are may be laid up on earth. Of course, we generally would just head put all of that under the heading of money or things or property and so forth. In the Lord's time, treasures were, or money would be invested in one of three ways. Perhaps in fine clothing, maybe in either possessions of some kind or grain that would be stored, and then sometimes just in money itself. Jesus said that the problem with all of those things, besides what they can do to a person himself, is that none of them are permanent. They all are subject to being marred or corroded or corrupted. The word he uses for corrupted is the same term he's used a little bit earlier about the Pharisees fasting and disfiguring their faces in the process. That's the idea here. He says that moth can consume. You ever watch Antiques Roadshow and see some of the garments or the cloth products that are really old and really valuable, but somehow a moth has gotten to a spot and just destroyed its value? You may not be troubled by moths, but that garment you have may be in 6 months so completely out of style that it's no use to you, or you may have grown so that it doesn't fit, or you might not even like it anymore. That's how temporary they are. And then there are the things that rust destroys. The word for rust is eaters. Some people believe it's talking about how mice and other pests ate grain that was stored up for food supplies at the time. Or thieves who would dig through the clay or the dirt walls of houses in order to steal what they regarded as the valuables that that family might possess. Any kind of earthly treasure is by nature temporary, if for no other reason than the fact that you guys, myself, didn't get here with any of them, and we surely are not going to take any of them with us. Everybody surely knows that as a fact, even if we don't act like it in principle. One of the illustrations that has stuck with me most is having been with our daughter Carrie and going through the Biltmore estate in Asheville, North Carolina. The Biltmore estate was constructed by George Washington Vanderbilt, the grandson of the Commodore himself. And about 1880 or so, he decided that he wanted to build this estate with his money, his inherited money. He began the process and didn't finish it until about 1897. He started it when he was about 27. Biltmore has 4 acres of floor space, 250 rooms, 34 family and guest bedrooms, 43 bathrooms, remember that's constructed just prior to 1900, 65 fireplaces, 3 kitchens, an indoor pool, a priceless collection of furniture and artifacts. It's equipped with every conceivable amenity, including refrigeration and an elevator or elevators. It's located, it has a 100,000 acre forest. several large farms attached to it, 250-acre wooded park, 5 pleasure gardens, 30 miles of paved woods. And the man behind it all died of appendicitis 15 years after the project was finished. There are no earthly treasures that are worthy of a man's life and soul and being. There just aren't. Jesus was not making a judgmental or a judicial statement here. He was talking about how life is. He counseled instead that we are to lay up for ourselves treasures in heaven. Remember from 1 Peter 1 and verse 4, our Father has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of His Son. He raises us to an inheritance which is incorruptible and undefiled and that fades not away. That means that in substance, this treasure will not waste away. In its beauty and purity, it won't be ruined, and its attraction for us will not lose its hold on us as time goes by. What Jesus is telling us here is to engage in the kinds of things that will make that inheritance more precious to us as time goes by. With our thoughts and our words and our deeds, the things that we're involved in, to act like that inheritance means everything to us. One of the writers who has described what laying up treasure in heaven may involve suggests that it's the development of things like the Christ-like character, since, of course, all we can take with us is ourselves. Or the increase of faith and hope and love, all of which Paul says abide, remember from 1 Corinthians 13. Or growing in the knowledge of Christ, whom we will one day see face to face. The active engagement by prayer and teaching of helping other people know Christ as well. The use of our money for the causes of the kingdom. And to bless people like God does. This last one is the thing the New Testament often emphasizes. In Luke chapter 12, some of these same phrases are used. Remember, there's Jesus is teaching, and one fellow comes up and interrupts and demands that the Lord tell his brother to share the inheritance with him. And Jesus has to stop and to say, listen, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And the Lord tells the story about the fellow who thinks he has everything and with his riches decides to tear down his barns and build bigger for himself. And intends to live like everything would always be as it was at that particular moment. Remember that night his soul was required of him. And Jesus said, so is the one who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. That's verse 21 of Luke 12. And then looking down toward the end of the chapter, verse 33 and 34, the Lord said, sell your possessions, give to the needy, provide yourselves with money bags that do not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will be your heart also. That's the same thing Jesus taught in Matthew 6, isn't it? Paul also in 1 Timothy 6, long toward the end of the letter, first letter to Timothy, says, as for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. Please notice that Jesus does not condemn being rich. He doesn't promise in any way that being a child of God will make you that way materially. He simply says to those who do have the world's goods, you're under obligation to use them to lay up a treasure in heaven. That's the idea. And the reason being, that's the enterprise that makes you a person who has a chance at happiness and honor in this present world. It's not just ending up without anything then. It's what one is now that interests the Lord as well. All right, that's the first principle. Have treasure that'll last. Do you have? Secondly, Jesus says, have a perspective that's healthy. Be a person who trains yourself to be able to see that which will elevate you as an individual as well. Jesus uses the imagery of having an eye which is single versus an eye which is evil. Dockery and Garland, in their little book on seeking the kingdom, suggest that a lamp, the eye is the lamp of the body. A lamp sends or emits light. As a lamp, the eye is depicted as radiating the light that resides within a person. And I've said that to ask you to look at this statement in a different way than we sometimes do. We often look at this only as if he's saying your eye takes in the light from the outside. If you can't see anything, then you're dark. But the darkness Jesus is talking about is that which is on the inside. When a person is seeking the treasure, laying up the treasures in heaven, he has a certain eye for things. He sees things in a certain way. He brings a perspective to life which is different. There is, both in this context and in the broader context of the Bible, the uses of the words that refer to the eye in this passage that gives them meaning that we're to understand. First, if your eye, so verse 22, so if your eye is healthy, this version says. The King James is closer to literal. If your eye is single, if it sees that one thing. In the Bible, this term is used frequently to talk about generosity. In Matthew 20 and verse 15, that fellow who hired everybody all through the day and then paid them all the same at the evening explained himself by saying he had this kind of an eye. In Romans 12 and verse 8, this is the word that's used for liberality or generosity. In 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 2, the same. In 2 Corinthians 9 verse 11 and verse 13, the same. This is the kind of a viewpoint, the kind of a perspective that would cause a person to want to share, to want to be generous. Now, of course, we're thinking about material goods, but with your heart, with your attention, with your time, with your caring, the same sort of thing. On the other hand, the word that's used when Jesus talks about, but if your eye is bad, verse 23, it's an evil eye. It's an eye which is grudging and self-centered and preoccupied with what am I going to get out of that sort of thing. In Deuteronomy 15 and verse 9, remember the Jews were required every 7 years they forgave debts and servants were freed and etc. And Moses told them, you be careful lest you develop an evil eye and you start calculating, this brother has asked me to help him, but it's the sixth year. What will happen next year when he doesn't have to pay me back? And so you don't help him. The Proverbs address this kind of thing as well. In Proverbs 22 and verse 9, whoever has a bountiful, this version says, the word is a single eye or a generous eye, will be blessed, for he shares his bread with the poor, as opposed to the evil eye, which does the opposite. In 23:6, it says, do not eat the bread of a man who is stingy. And literally, it's a man whose eye is evil. Do not desire his delicacies, it says. What Jesus is telling us here is that if we get to the place where all that's inside of us is littleness and smallness and selfishness, then that's what we will see when we look at other people. And we won't get to be the individuals who allow the Son to bless the just and the unjust, like our Father is in Matthew 5 and verse 42, or who do the right thing without getting any attention for it, as Jesus mentions in chapter 6 and verse 13, who are able to do unto others as we would have them do unto us, as chapter 7 and verse 12 says. It's really important in a world with a lot of stuff that we have a single eye, a focus on the Lord and His way, an attention to something that lasts. And then the third thing the Lord says here is have an owner who will care about you. In verse 24, the imagery when it says no one can serve two masters, it'd be maybe clearer if we said it. Nobody can be a slave to two owners. You and I might be able, if so motivated, to go out and work two jobs. You know, this one in the early day and this one in the evening, or this one at night, this one in the daytime, whatever. We could, I suppose, could do that. But that would cause us to understand Jesus just to be commanding us not to try to serve two masters, when what he's saying is, look, it can't be done. It's not doable for someone to be answerable to two owners at the same time. He will, even if he sets out to try to serve them both, he will find his attention divided. He'll be the opposite of the single mind. He'll be double-minded, as James describes it in James chapter 1. He'll be defeated when he starts. And the reason is that material things and covetousness for them can turn into idolatry so quickly. At the end of verse 24, when Jesus says you cannot serve God and money, I think it would be better personally if the translation had just left the word for money, its original word, mammon. Mammon was an Aramaic word just put into Greek letters, like the words Abba or Maranatha or Hosanna or those types of words. It had a special meaning, and the meaning was material things as a god. Jesus is talking about you can't do what people tried to do back in the days of Israel and the Assyrians. You can't worship their gods and the God of heaven at the same time. And the point being here that you and I need to recognize that our money, our things, can so easily take over and start to rule us, but they don't care for us. We care for them. We need an owner, a father, to whom we're devoted and who will care for us, and he won't stop caring for us. That's the idea that's dwelt on in this passage. Many years ago, a London newspaper offered a prize for the best definition of money that could be submitted. And here's the winning entry. Money is an instrument that can buy you everything but happiness and pay your fare to every place but heaven. It's a pretty good definition. And it gets awful close to what Jesus is teaching in this passage. So look at the text and ask yourself the questions. Where's your heart? Where your treasure is, that's where your heart is. Treasure first and then heart, or heart and then treasure. What do you see? And who's your master? Those are the questions the Lord asks. In studying this, I was reminded of how different the conclusion of one of our songs is to my friend Rue's description back in that basement in Leipzig in 1945. These words were part of the favorite song of our sister Helen Hall. Sister Hall was Sharon Joseph's mother. She didn't have a whole bunch of stuff. Her husband was a gospel preacher. Brother Feeney did his memorial service back when he passed on. But Sister Hall's favorite song was, "The Lord has been mindful of me." And the last stanza says, "I'm rich, I'm saved, I'm happy, I've health and prosperity. I have friends. I have doors ever open. The Lord has been mindful of me. The Lord has been mindful of me. He blesses and blesses again. My God is the God of the living. How excellent is His name." You need an owner like that. And you can have through the gospel. Anybody here could make the good confession and to be baptized into Christ and be owners of the promises of God. Anybody here could also be drawn away into the service of stuff and could need to recognize that and to get first things first in life again. And if you're here in either case today, and if we could help you, won't you please let us know by coming while we stand and sing.